condition which compromises the immune system. Despite that, she went on to win 11 singles titles in her career and reached the third round of Wimbledon in 2002. However, her career was blighted by injury and illness, and she finally retired in November last year. The 30-year-old also played Fed Cup tennis for Great Britain for 11 years. Current team captain Judy Murray says everyone around her is staying positive.
And a plane from Paris to Detroit has made an emergency landing at Belfast International Airport after a passenger went into labour. The captain had to ask for special permission to touch down there. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is former Bristol MP, now Labour councillor for Avonmouth, Doug Naismith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well, Kiev is in the hands of the pro-EU Ukrainians, but Sevastopol and Crimea is in the hands of the pro-Russians. The tug of war is possibly over the regional administrations around Ukraine, particularly in the east. Just in from the eastern Ukrainian city of Kharkov, this week is the politics show's Marina Morris. She'll be giving her perspective on the last few weeks of turmoil, on what could be possibly the reuniting of her country. Plus, Mohamed Al-Fayed's banned documentary about the Diana inquest, Unlawful Killing, was shot and directed by singer Lily Allen's dad, Keith Allen, back in 2011. Only in the last few weeks, it's appeared on YouTube for the first time. How long will it last there? Why was it banned? And more importantly, what does it say? And the other fundamentalism. This week saw one of the most important events in the US political calendar, the AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C. Who are AIPAC? What are they saying? And why are they so powerful? And last weekend saw the National Conference of the Positive Money Group in London, who have plans to kick out most of the city and sort out our money system once and for all. Next weekend, a similar seminar is being held here in Bristol. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. So on to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and dry, highs of 13 Celsius this weekend. It's almost like spring today, isn't it? It's like the first day of spring. Cloudier and windier on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday. Next week, that's highs of 13 again. This is really warming up now. Fairly sunny week. Next weekend, 15th and 16th of March, highs back down a little bit again to 10 Celsius. Sunny all weekend next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is the former Bristol MP, now Labour councillor for Avonmouth, Doug Naismith. Hi, Doug, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, Doug, tell us how you're settling into being a councillor. You were, I think you stood down, didn't you, in the 2010 elections as an MP?
I did, yes, I did. I was hoping to retire, but in the end I was persuaded to stand in Avonmouth and didn't win the ward, actually. It was actually a tie, and I became a councillor for 4 years.
How do you do that? Hang on, if it's a tie, surely you have to have a rerun, don't you?
Well, not in British politics, you don't. Well, you have recounts. It was after 3 recounts that it was still tied. And what happens is that the returning officer wrote the 2 names on 2 bits of paper, put them into a ballot box, and drew out one of them, and it was me.
Right, so you're there by some kind of fluke, really, rather than by election.
Well, it is a bit of a fluke, really, because I'd been on the council. I was first elected to the council in 1981, and then in 2010, I became a... Sorry, 1997, I became an MP for Bristol North West, and then theoretically retired, as you said, in 2010.
Now, tell us...
And on the same day, as I retired, I was elected to the council.
Now, tell us a bit of the story of Bristol North West, because hasn't there been some changes in the constituency boundaries?
And, yes, I mean,
Bristol
North
West. We used to have several, I think it was the Filton and Abbey Wood, is it possibly? That Filton constituency, anyway.
That was in Bristol North West.
Airbus
and Rolls Royce.
And how did that happen?
It was just a boundary revision. They happen every now and again. It wasn't demanded by anyone particularly. It was the Boundary Commission redrew the boundaries because the population grows and then you have to sort of redraw boundaries every now and again.
Is there a bit of chicanery goes on with these Boundary Commission things, or is it all totally above board, do you think?
Well, it's totally above board in one sense, in that it's independently done, but there are hearings and the various political parties make their cases for and against. The interesting thing about the current Bristol North West is it has been won for Labour before. Some people say, oh, now the boundaries have changed. It's, but almost exactly the same boundaries were won before by, I think it was Ron Thomas who won it a number of years ago now.
So how come, I mean, you're the former Labour MP for that area, how come it's now gone over to the Conservatives? Explain, please.
Well, the boundaries did change between my last election and the one where Charlotte won against another candidate.
I mean, that's Charlotte Leslie, the current sitting MP there.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are you up to on the council then? What committees are you on, Doug?
Well, basically, I'm on two scrutiny committees. I have always been someone who encouraged young people, so I didn't want to take any particularly onerous position, which meant excluding, because there's a lot of good young talent in the Labour group now. You've probably had some of them in here. And so
we can get through to them on their BlackBerry phones, council BlackBerry phones that don't seem to work.
Well, some council IT doesn't seem to work terribly well, but we have got, you know, a very good organisation which will immediately sort things out if people get in touch with them quickly. But however, there may well be a problem with the BlackBerrys.
And also the email, apparently. I was chatting to organise her coming on in the next few weeks, Vari Threlfall, who's
new, she's one of the young talented ones I'm talking
about.
And
she was saying that she hasn't been getting emails through from her council email account, and neither is her BlackBerry working. So it's very difficult, isn't it, when the constituents are trying to get in touch with their councillor and the equipment that the councillor's provided for that to happen simply doesn't work. I mean, her mobile number, for example, is advertised right across the city as a way to get in touch with your councillor.
And well, that's
if
the
it's
way
not
to
working,
get in touch with someone very quickly, but you can. There are lots of other ways you can.
Okay, so the message is, if you're trying to get hold of your councillor and the communications are all broken, City Council IT department has fallen down on the job, try another method.
Well, you can telephone the council and you will get eventually put through to your councillor, or telephone the Labour group office if it's a Labour councillor, or it applies with the other groups as well. If you want to be put through to a councillor and you can't get through to them direct, get in touch with the council, ask to be put through to the appropriate party office.
It's the old adage, isn't it, really? Don't give up.
Don't give up. But okay. I mean, if that's the case, it has only happened recently. I don't think it's been a long-standing problem, and we'll wait and see what happens.
Well, I'd been trying to get hold of several councillors on their BlackBerrys over a period of about, we say, 6 weeks, 2 months, and had no luck at all. So eventually managed to get through via the Labour office.
Maybe they're not all that keen to let you get in touch with them. Maybe they
possibly
aren't as keen to come on.
Well,
as you think they are,
I don't know if they can actually block my texts going through to their phones as well, if they're actually techno-savvy enough to do that. But anyway, back to you, Doug.
Your scrutiny
committees. What are you scrutinising?
I scrutinise the Health and Wellbeing Board, the commission. I'm a member of that, which basically, because there has been a big change, as you will be well aware, in the way the National Health Service is run. And one of the things that is the biggest change is that the local authorities are much more involved in commissioning services than they were under the old system. The body that used to do the commissioning has been abolished, and councils in various ways have taken over for the commissioning, and it's a very important thing now. And there's a problem there, because Bristol has had trouble getting our officer, the health officer, the one who's the public health officer who's in charge of health in the council. And this was part of the arrangements, that this was to be the body that runs public health, was to be very much involved in commissioning and be the linchpin in getting good services contracted. And Bristol has lost two chief officers of public health, and that's a bit of a problem, and partly it's because I think the council has not given the priority that should be given to public health and getting someone to replace the Hugh, who retired just recently.
Now, what you're saying there does sound a bit worrying. It sounds to me like the council are having a greater role in supposedly in health. Central government lets go a bit,
yeah.
And yet the council's falling down on the job.
Well, in some councils that I know up and down the country, the Health and Wellbeing Board, which is the board which oversees this function, is chaired by the leader of the council, and they give it really high priority, and that's not the case in Bristol, and it's something that I've raised once or twice, and I'm not happy about it myself.
I mean, are you allowed to do anything other than just raise these things at the scrutiny?
Raising them, there are various ways of following up. I mean, you can ask particular questions for the Lord Mayor in public, and that, the Mayor, not the Lord Mayor, the elected Mayor. But George has absolute authority in everything at the end of the day, and councillors decide very little.
I mean, surely
scrutiny is very important.
So if you feel that you're not getting what you need from your job scrutinising things, can you go straight to George? Have you tried to do that? Is that
you
easy?
You can go straight to George, yes. And George, I was not in favour of having an elected mayor, and didn't vote for one, didn't vote in the referendum to have one, and didn't vote for one for George. But at the end of the day, well, there's a really funny little twist to this story, that the legislation, which is first of all cabinet government and Lord Mayors, came in under a Labour government when I was in the House of Commons, and I think I probably supported some of it, which was probably a great mistake. But, you know, be careful what you wish for. And
so you voted through the very legislation that you then didn't want to happen in Bristol?
Yep, that's right.
Dear Doug.
But then there's been a lot of evidence since it was voted through. It was quite a while ago, because it was the cabinet system first, and then...
Yeah, but how's it working out in practice now, then?
I think it's difficult to tell. It's still a bit too soon to decide whether it's going to work or not.
But, you know, what are your indications, or what are the indications particularly? I mean, for example, we've just had last month the budget, haven't we?
Yes, the budget. Yep. We had the budget.
Did that work out as it normally does? Do you think that most councils got the opportunity to scrutinise it, ask questions,
The Lib Dems are very unhappy about what happened. They feel that they weren't given a proper chance to get the things that they wanted through. But that's part of the system, and it might have happened under the old system as well, in that their amendments were disallowed. Whereas the Labour group did pretty well out of the budget, and George... In the end, there was another $2 million put back in the budget because the Labour councillors refused to accept the budget in its original form and wanted it amended, and it was amended.
So that sounds a little bit naughty to me. The Lib Dems have come up with some amendments, and they're ruled out of order.
There is a finance officer who decides whether these... Section 105 officer who decides whether these are allowable in terms of... for financial reasons, theoretically, and they weren't allowed. Because if you introduce an amendment to anybody's budget, either the Leader of Council's budget or the Mayor's budget, you have to be able to move money from one place to another place in order to effect the change that you want. And it was said that the money that they wanted to move was not available for moving. Now,
okay.
It all sounds very technical, and we probably not to get into it in too great detail, but that's what happened.
Now, this week also, we've had some pretty shocking announcements about the Stephen Lawrence case in London, a public inquiry to be set up, finally, after all these years, into the surveillance, particularly the surveillance of the Lawrence family by the police immediate aftermath of his death, and also looking into what many have called Stasi tactics of the police by infiltrating peaceful groups, groups that haven't committed any kind of criminal offences and aren't intending to, just simply to get information from them, with police officers undercover, sleeping with, possibly even having children with activists who have actually not even broken the law. Doug, what are your thoughts about that announcement yesterday?
Well, let's stick with this, the Stephen Lawrence thing for a bit. We can go on to the wider aspects in a minute or two if you like, but I think it's quite clear that there have been terribly tragic effects and things have happened in the Stephen Lawrence affair which should never have happened in any police force, and it's been a cover-up from right from the start, and it's something that I feel quite strongly about because I've always been a little bit involved with the police, and I was on the police authority for 2 or 3 years, and by and large almost every member of the police force that I came across, certainly in senior positions, seemed to me pretty straight and pretty competent and didn't strike me as possibly being corrupt. But it's quite clear, and it, if you take other things like the Sheffield affair with the football supporters and
Hillsborough,
and various other things that have happened recently, it's quite clear that in some parts of the police force there are rotten apples and there's this tendency to cover up which has to be rooted out. So I'm hoping that this inquiry will unleash and or open up certain things that have happened in particularly the Lawrence affair that will lead to changes and more open. Although, as I say, my own personal relationships with Avon and Somerset Police have always been pretty straightforward, and I've never had reason to doubt that they were honest and non-corrupt.
But, I mean, these are the very police officers, I mean, not obviously here in Avon and Somerset, but in the Metropolitan Police, that were likely to have signed off these operations. I mean, it's very easy to focus on the individual officers who were sent in to infiltrate, for example, the Lawrence family and elsewhere. But these operations surely were signed off up the food chain.
Yes, I think they probably were, but I don't think they were signed off by politicians, and I'm pretty sure they weren't signed off by politicians, but certainly at a very high level in the police force, although Paul Congdon, the previous Met Commissioner, has denied that he knew anything about this, but no doubt these things will be investigated in the inquiry that's to happen. Now, when it comes to people getting embedded in protest groups, that's totally condemnable. It just shouldn't happen. We are entitled to protest in this country lawfully and to do things, cause public nuisance in a reasonable way, and just to infiltrate groups like that and to go so far as to form relationships and, as you say, maybe even having children, because that's on record, that's just unsupportable and should not happen.
Doreen Lawrence today says she is Baroness Lawrence, of course, now in
the House of Lords.
Says that she wants heads to roll.
Well, I mean,
Met police heads.
Yes, Met. But I mean, there's also somebody, there's a senior policeman, I forget what it was, who said it's not just the Met. Well, obviously it isn't. If you take Hillsborough into account, there are other places where things happen. And so if the trouble is with these historic things, it's very difficult to get witnesses but who are credible and who can come to court. But the fact is, heads should roll if they can be brought to justice.
Doug, the other big problem, of course, is the Jimmy Savile inquiry. Yeah. I mean, it does seem to look as if these corruption in the past with the police, because quite clearly people did go forward to the police who were abused by Jimmy Savile and nothing was done about it, that there is a crisis of confidence. Do you think that a public inquiry, although it will not take place certainly for several months, it seems, until existing inquiries, it won't start until then, will get to the bottom of all this and actually reform the police for the better?
I think we have to be careful all the time, because there was another senior policeman I heard on the radio the other day who said that there's always the possibility of corruption in the police simply because of the temptations that are on offer. It's probably much more likely in London in the Metropolitan Police than anywhere else, because that's where a lot of the financial crime and big crime takes place. But it certainly is possible in any police force, and so vigilance is important. Whether it will be able to be rooted out or not in the forthcoming inquiries is a matter that we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Well, the public inquiry is going to be looking at this thing called the Special Demonstration Squad, which is a top secret squad within the Metropolitan Police Special Branch, operational from 1968 in the wake of anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, right the way up till 2006, specialised in long-term undercover deployment of officers. Martin Summers, what do you make of all this talk about the Stephen Lawrence case again, and whether that you think a public inquiry really will make a difference?
Well, we've got to distinguish two things here. One is corruption, and the other is what you might call political policing. And I think the two things are interlinked in the Lawrence case, because I used to live in South London at the time it happened, and the word on the street was that the lads that killed Lawrence thought they could get away with it because they were part of a criminal family. Their father had a lot of cops on the payroll, and that's why the things weren't done properly.
Yeah.
And at one stage, they went round to the lad's house and took away bin bags full of evidence and then just disposed of it. And these lads thought they could get away with it because their dad was known as the biggest sort of dope dealer in South London, basically. And of course, if you're a big dope dealer like that, you've got to have some cops on the payroll. It's part of the, it's part of what you do. And I'm afraid, I don't think anybody should be shocked by this. Police. No. I mean, my uncle was in the police in Birmingham for 25 years, and there's always going to be, I mean, don't forget, organised criminals target police officers to corrupt them. And of course, they can also compromise them. Yeah, once they've taken some money off somebody, they're then in, and they find it very difficult to turn back. But the political policing aspect of it is that they were infiltrating the Lawrence campaign to see what they were up to, so that the police could then counter whatever moves were being made. So the initial problem was probably because you got corrupt officers who are not investigating this properly because they're on the payroll of the criminals. Then you get the political police cover up. We're going to infiltrate into the organisation and second guess the family and so on. But I think this thing about having children with targets, this is like East Germany. There's no doubt about it. And people in this country have got to recognise that there is a state within the state. It's been there for a long time, and ultimately it will have to be dealt with.
Could I just say, I think it's really important that Martin was talking about people being in the pay of, you know, criminals, really. Mm. Their fellow officers often know or suspect that something's going on, and what we have to counteract as well is this tendency to close ranks and not to point out fellow officers.
Well, what my uncle used to say is, another people who know is that you tend to have two kinds of police officers, the bent ones and the straight ones, and they don't drink together, they don't socialise together, they're two different social groups.
Could well be, yeah.
Ultimately, though, Martin, do you think this public inquiry will really make a difference? Because, I mean, the Lawrence family have been calling for something like this for nearly 20 years.
Well, I mean, the point about justice is that you never give up. Yeah. I mean, that's what you say to any criminal at any level, whoever you are. You may get away with it now, you may get away with it tomorrow, you may get away with it next week, but we will get you in the end. And that's what everybody's got to understand who's involved in any criminal behaviour, whether it's in Lloyd's Bank or in the supermarket.
Okay, well, talking about the city, and Martin beautifully led us in there, this week, city heavyweights, a warning of stock shocks ahead. This is in the Independent yesterday. Two veterans of the stock market reported record results today, but both warned investors to stand by for shocks. Lord Rothschild, whose RIT Capital Partners looks after $2.1 billion of his own family, his dynasty, and other long-term investors' money, said, with the world recovery still fragile and reliant to a large extent on policy support, imagine by that he means quantitative easing, printing money, it's not hard to envisage markets having to deal with shocks in the coming year, Martin.
Well, that's right. I mean, the mainstream economic debate in this country about whether unemployment is falling and how it's measured and whether the economy is growing or not, there's a lot of meat on that. But the fundamental problem is that the global economy, of which the City of London is a key part, is an incredibly fragile state. They started reducing the amount of quantitative easing in the US. They're not even stopping quantitative easing, they're just trying to reduce the amount they're feeding in every month. And that caused an immediate crisis in all the emerging market economies. In Argentina, in Turkey, in Thailand, in Ukraine. There's been a run on the banks in the Ukraine, which we're not hearing a lot about. And the real danger is that through a whiplash effect, comes back into the mainstream markets in the West, in London and Wall Street, and just crashes the whole lot. And I'm afraid we've wasted 4 years. They've 4 or 5 years. They've been the locust years, where we've basically just bailed out a completely corrupt financial sector with public sector resources. And when it crashes, we won't have any resources. And people say, well, where's all the money gone? Well, it's in the Cayman Islands.
No, I mean, we're always hearing that people in the city and commentators, financial journalists, are always trying to talk up the stock market because they're afraid of talking it down and causing a depression. So why should anyone listen to Jacob Rothschild?
Well, he's one of the richest men in the world and he's an insider. I mean, what's interesting is when people like that start saying there's a problem, then there is a problem. Don't forget that people who work in financial services, their job is to sell optimism. They're not saying don't buy this, they're saying buy this. And that's why you can't trust their advice, because they've got an interest in selling the stuff and talking it all up. I think most objective economists sitting in university departments, for example, can see that this is the biggest bubble in history, and when it pops, it's going to be catastrophic. And I think the Labour leadership, front bench leadership, really need a plan B if something like that happens. I don't want to hear if it does happen or who could have predicted that. They need to recognise it's a definite possibility.
Well, in case they don't, Positive Money have got a plan B, and we'll be talking about that in the second hour. But
I think the Labour Party is quite good at having a plan B, but it's not going to run around shouting about it at the moment.
No.
I'm pretty sure there is one. But could I just say the one thing that I think would make a huge difference to the economy, and I just cannot understand why it doesn't happen, is that we start building more houses. There's a shortage of houses. There are people unemployed in the trade.
Well, I'll tell you why that won't happen.
No.
And that's because it will depress the house prices. If you start having actually meeting the demand for houses, then the price of housing will start going down.
You've got a long way to go before we meet the demand for houses. There's a great shortage of houses in Bristol and everywhere else. And if we built some more houses, that would solve one problem,
okay.
But it would also
solve... When is the money for that going to come from, Doug?
Well, the governments can pump money in for that sort of thing, instead of pumping money in to encourage people to borrow money, which is what they're doing.
Are they? How are they doing that?
Well, the mortgage, making mortgage facilities available.
Help to sell.
It's immediately started pushing up the prices, because it's not going to be that many more houses built under it.
Okay, revealed in error. The official files that show Britain will not support military action against Russia. Now, this was a very embarrassing... the Deputy National Security Advisor left his all these secret notes available for photographers in Downing Street. We'll be discussing that in a minute. But first, let's go to Westminster for Prime Minister's questions, and let's hear an exchange on Ukraine between the Leader of the Opposition, Ed Miliband, and David Cameron, the Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the whole House and the whole country has been watching events in Ukraine with great concern. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that Russia's actions in surrounding Ukrainian military sites, violating Ukraine's sovereignty, independence and territorial integrity, are completely without any justification? And does he further agree that these actions deserve to be condemned unreservedly across the international community?
Yeah. Prime Minister...
Well, first of all, I agree with the right honourable gentleman that what Russia has done is completely unacceptable. We should be clear about our national interest and our aim in all of this. Our national interest is that we have a strong interest in a world where the rule of law is upheld, where territorial integrity is respected, stability is a vital part of our long-term economic plan, and we should be clear that our aim is to deter further Russian military action and to de-escalate this situation. And he's completely right to say that the action by the Russian government should be condemned by the whole
world, I think he was saying there. So Doug Naismith, you're a former MP for Bristol North West, now Labour councillor for Avonmouth. Can you just give us your take on this Ukraine situation, and also the Leader of the Opposition, your chief, your boss, Ed Miliband's comments there?
Well, I think this is a very serious situation, and Ed is quite right to make it quite clear that it is a serious situation. But I have to myself having lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 60s, I don't think it's quite as serious or not nearly as frightening as that was when we were only a few days away from a possible nuclear strike.
Well, apparently the food disappeared from the supermarkets. I remember my auntie telling me, in 1963, 1962.
And there was constant television of what was happening and interviews all over the place. Now, it's still serious what we've got here, but I think it can be worked out by proper diplomacy. I think it's a great pity that some rather silly Tory has given away that the Prime Minister doesn't think it's worth having any kind of military engagement by not keeping the... It was a civil servant, I think, but it was, you know, the government papers. And I think that's a bit silly, but I don't want to see military action either. And I need strong leadership from the USA and also from NATO and from the European Union, which is involved, incidentally, in this thing quite heavily.
I mean, do you think that the, as Ed Miliband's saying there, that there's been an invasion by Russia of the Crimea? Because, I mean, they had an agreement, didn't they, previously with the Ukrainian government to keep it for, I think it was 25 years or something. You know, it's a bit, it seems to me a little bit of a dispute over whether that is really part of Ukraine, Crimea.
Well, I mean, I think it's obvious that there are people in the Crimean Peninsula who would rather be Russian than be part of Europe or the European Union, which, because there were talks about what was going to happen with the European Union, and they kind of failed, and then that's really what started the whole thing off, an attempt to link up with Europe rather than with Russia in terms of trade and so on. And it's grown and built up, and I think it's serious, but Martin will be able to explain the ins and outs of it much better than I can.
Martin, David Cameron's advisor, National Security Advisor Hugh Powell, didn't seem to take his own advice as a National Security Advisor as he wandered in to Downing Street with... and that, actually, bless them, the Daily Mail have done a very good job in going through what was written on this piece of paper and then saying what it says on the piece of paper and then translating it to what it really means.
Yeah.
But Martin, what they're basically saying is that there shouldn't be any kind of real intervention, and what they've ended up doing is saying, oh, well, we're going to withdraw our support for the Paralympic Games.
Well, that's right. I mean, there is not a lot they can actually do, and of course the City of London, I mean, this, the real killer is that we can't freeze the Russians out of the City of London. Blimey, that's money involved isn't it? Let's get serious. I think it is a very, very dangerous situation, but not like as bad as the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Daily Mail, on their online Daily Mail, have reported the telephone conversation between Catherine Ashton, EU foreign spokesperson, and the foreign minister of Finland, of Estonia.
To be fair, it wasn't much of a conversation. It was just him speaking to her and her going,
Yes, because what he was saying, what he was saying to her, and the Estonians have confirmed that it's a genuine transcript, what he was saying to her is the information that he was getting was that the protesters that were shot in the Maidan were being shot by snipers from the opposition fascist parties. So they're shooting their own demonstrators in order to create a crisis situation. And this has happened before in Venezuela. It happened in Syria. And, of course, it's Western intelligence services who are behind this kind of destabilisation. And the Russian intelligence services, it was actually Yanukovych's intelligence services who got the phone call. Now, it may be that this is disinformation, but the Estonians have said that it's a genuine phone call. Now, it could be that the Estonian foreign minister got it wrong, but that's what he was being told by doctors.
Okay, back to this leak, though, Martin, you raised your point there. Yeah. But what does it tell us about how government really works? Because it seems like it's actually the City of London that's telling David Cameron what to do, and he's just simply doing what he's told.
I mean, we pretty much knew that, but this just confirms
it. But he's making it. I mean, Cameron is talking in all sorts of principles about this at stake and that at stake, democracy, the people's rights, and actually he's just following a script written by the city, it seems.
Yes, and of course the Russians are staring at the eyeball to eyeball. Putin's support inside Russia has gone up. They did some opinion poll thing, 70% support him, 100%. They don't see that, you know, what happens in international crisis, like in the run-up to the First World War, is people's perceptions are completely different about the same set of events. And I don't think there's much point trying to beat the other side over the head and make them have your perception. What you've got to do is recognise that everybody's got their interests at stake here, and deals have to be done. as they were done in Northern Ireland, as they're hopefully going to be done in Israel-Palestine, etc. It's not the end of the world when people fall into disagreement. But what is worrying is this militarisation of the situation. And I suspect, if this phone call is correct, and it's a genuine phone call, and I think it sounds very, very plausible to me, because we know that NATO intelligence services have been involved in exactly this kind of destabilisation before.
Okay, more problems as well this week at Downing Street. I say problems, I mean this is very serious, is there's a cover-up over a senior aide, Patrick Rock's arrest on child abuse image allegations. The big problem here, from many of the news media's point of view, and the public I'm sure too, is that this was kept secret for nearly 3 weeks from everybody, that there'd been an arrest in Downing Street with the senior aide, the guy who was in charge of an internet filter to do with pornography, actually being himself arrested at charges of having child pornography images.
Well, clearly there's something gone wrong there, and it's not anything that anybody could say is a good thing. I mean, we wait to find out a bit more about what's been going on.
But ironic,
but
isn't
clearly,
it?
Clearly, well, it's A, ironic, as you say, that the person who's supposed to be checking on images that are available on the internet for people to download, turns out that he himself has been accused of similar behaviour. We don't know yet whether that's going to turn into actuality or not, but keeping it quiet for 3 weeks is perhaps the most surprising aspect of it all.
One of these aspects of this pornography block that David Cameron has tried to put on is it actually, Martin, includes lots and lots of other things as well.
Yeah.
It's, for example, esoteric websites, things which are looking at, maybe minor religions, different. I mean, it's actually a vast amount of stuff which is being blocked. In fact, we heard, didn't we, that the website of one of the MPs that was sponsoring the legislation was blocked itself, even though she was just mentioning a few terms on there which were to do with the legislation, that this internet block was blocking her website.
Yes, well,
too.
That's because computers are quite stupid, really, aren't they? So that they don't realise, because she's saying all these sexual words in her blog,
picks
it up and says, this is a porn site.
It does sound to me as if this block is not really just looking at pornography, it's actually some kind of censorship block.
Well, I mean, we've got to be very aware of that. I mean, things like this telephone transcript I was talking about a minute ago, that's come out, it's been on CNN, it's been on the Mail, and that was originally on the internet, and of course the Western powers would not like that to have come out.
The trouble with censoring things is when you start censoring things, it tends to grow and people keep adding things in.
It
may well be the right thing to do to censor pornography sites, but you've got to be careful spread.
Well, child pornography is illegal. Period. It always has been.
Yeah.
It's quite straightforward. I mean, you can put filters on. If you've got children, you can put filters on your computers to stop them going to porn sites. It's not difficult, really. But the more interestingly, and that's what I would like to pick up on, is the Daily Mail have been running this story about the paedophile information exchange in the National Council for Civil Liberties in the 1970s. Now, what I want to know is, was somebody at the Daily Mail tipped off that a senior Tory was about to be done for potentially downloading pornographic children's images?
You have a suspicious mind, Martin.
Yes, I can't help it. I don't know what it is. It's just got
Martin
a suspicious
is a great
mind.
Supporter of the conspiracy theory of life.
Well, no, it may be that I'm just complete. There's nothing to see folks. But I mean, I think various Labour MPs have pointed this out, because that would explain why they didn't brief immediately.
Their attempt to blackmail, or blackwash, if there's such a phrase, Harriet Harman is just ridiculous, because she's one of the nicest people you could ever meet.
Well,
and I'm quite sure she wasn't involved.
One of the this
in
individual
pie.
Patrick Rock's previous jobs was as an aide for many years in Brussels to Commissioner Chris Patten, who's now the chairman of the BBC. And yet this guy was very close to him for many years, at one of the senior jobs in the world.
Yeah. Well, I'm just emphasising the fact that I don't believe that Harriet Harman, who was employed as a relatively junior lawyer at the National Association of Civil Liberties, was a supporter of PIE. Just ridiculous decisions.
Well, I remember that era. I remember.
So do
I. And I think I went to see Tom O'Carroll speak, who's the PIE guy, when I was at university, because I just thought, what's he got to say?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I don't really agree with this, but I listened to what he had to say.
Yeah, we used to listen to all sorts of weird and wonderful opinions in those days.
fury as Tory party donors are handed NHS contracts worth £1.5 billion under health reforms. This is in the Daily Mirror. Actually, middle of last month, I missed this one. Shadow Health Secretary Andy Burnham has uncovered links between private health firms and prominent Conservative supporters. Circle Health landed £1.36 billion worth of health service work after several of its investors gifted £1.5 million to the Conservative Party. Martin, on the surface of it, this one just seems to be government contracts awarded to businesses and individuals in exchange for donations into the Conservative Party central office.
Yeah, well, this is a fundamental problem with our democracy, isn't it? It is about money. Politics does require funds, and look at the rowings and difficulties we're having about trade union funding of the Labour Party at the moment. At the end of the day, money does talk. I mean, in the US, this has gone to even further lengths than it's gone here. Ultimately, the political system is dysfunctional, A, because the electoral system's so archaic in this country, but B, because ultimately, the City of London gets bailed out, then it uses the bailout money to buy the government to carry on getting more bailout money, which is why Milton Friedman argued against bailing out anything, whether it's a car industry or a bank, because once you've bailed them out, they keep coming back for more. And we've seen that in spades with the City of London.
Well, a company called Lansdowne Partners with a 29.2% stake was founded by Sir Paul Ruddock, who donated nearly £700,000 to the Conservative Party, Doug.
This is not surprising news, because it's, I mean, this sort of thing's been known for a long time, and sadly, I mean, I agree with Martin.
But isn't it corruption? I mean,
it is corruption.
If you're giving somebody money, okay, yeah, it is corruption. Okay.
It is corruption. You're speaking to someone whose expenses were whiter than white. No one raised any question about my expenses. So there is no question of corruption in my background. So I'm quite happy to condemn other people, not all MPs, for being corrupt. But the electoral system, I agree with Martin. There are so many flaws in our electoral system. I mean, if we go on to a different... I'll come back to this corruption in a minute. If you go into the fact that we're going to have an election next year where there might be four or five parties standing, what that means with our electoral system, the way it is, the first part the post. Somebody could have been elected as a Member of Parliament with 25-30% of the votes, which is ridiculous. And there's a whole lot of things that about our system that needs changing, although I must say it works better than in many other countries in the world.
Okay,
but going back to health, I think we've gone too far with this separation off of, we were talking earlier about contracting and purchaser-provider split in the National Health Service. It opens up many more opportunities for this kind of thing, whereby people donate money so that a company that they have an interest in gets a contract.
Well, while we're on the subject of health, let's go back to Westminster and the Commons, where there was a question asked about the East Coast Ambulance Service, which has just gone bust.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Recently, East Coast Ambulance Service, a private company, has gone bust, owing thousands of pounds in wages to hard-working staff. Does the Prime Minister agree that the best way to protect patients, staff and NHS resources is to extend freedom of information to private companies bidding for NHS contracts and stop the invasion of our NHS by predatory private healthcare companies?
Obviously, I'll look carefully at the individual case that he raises, but what I would say is this government is putting £12.7 billion into the NHS, and I don't believe that we should rule out saying that other organisations cannot help to deliver NHS services. If we look at the Hinchingbrook Hospital in Cambridge, it is now providing much better services because of the changes that we've made. I'll look at what he says about the freedom of information request, but I think it's important that we have a health service that can access the best of both public, private and voluntary.
Doug Naismith, you're the Labour councillor for Avonmouth. Can you just give us an idea of how you can be in a situation where something as important as an ambulance service can just go bust?
Well, it's because of the contracting system, the purchaser-provider split. Services are commissioned by an organisation. It's now partly in this part of the world by the Bristol City Council through the Health and Wellbeing Committee and purchasing. And if enough money is not raised, then and more money spent than is raised, then an ambulance can go bust. I believe in going back to the roots, really, of the National Health Service and having a largely publicly provided National Health Service. Now, that doesn't mean it goes back totally to what it was before, because there were a certain amount of complacency in various parts of the NHS, and waiting lists were quite long before this split was introduced. But it needs to be rationalised much further, so that we have a largely national health service paid out of taxation, which can bid for contracts but not run whole chunks of the National Health Service.
Well, this is East Coast, thankfully, not here. Are there any parts of the National Health Service in Bristol that you're a little bit worried about, you know, as private businesses now, that it would be quite a serious problem if they went bust?
Well, the mental health partnership, not currently, but a couple of years ago, was in a pretty bad way, but it's now been boosted up and just been reprovisioned, and I have every anticipation that the mental health partnership that we now have or will have soon is going to be much better than that. But there have been once or twice, there have been bits of the local National Health Service which were a bit dodgy.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this East Coast Ambulance Service going bust?
Well, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah. It's an absurdity. Yeah. And we've got so used to this absurdity in this country that we're not surprised when stupid things like this happen. Absolutely ridiculous. And there's a fundamental problem, and we have this in the New Labour era as well, is that the public and private do not mix, in fact, not very well. Yeah. Not Ernie Bevan, Aniron Bevan resigned from the front bench in the 1950s, they'd just brought in payments for spectacles. Spectacles had been free, but in order to try and, you know, balance the books, people were going to have to pay for their spectacles. And he resigned from the government on this issue, and people were saying, well, it's only spectacles. No. We're not asking him. So, no, it's the principle of the thing. Yeah. Once you can start people paying, there'll be no end to it. And you know what? He was right. Once you start people paying, there's no end to it. And of course, you're going in the wrong direction all the way. The idea that you can mix public and private doesn't make sense, actually, because it's either public or it's private.
Well, the problem with that is that the National Health Service loses all sorts of services. You know, buys motor cars, buys ambulances, all that sort of thing. And these are provided by the private sector. So there's always going to, as a whole load of things are. There's always going to be a mix. But when it comes to clinical things, I absolutely agree with you that as little as possible ought to be from the private sector.
Okay, well, back to Westminster now. And a local MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy, was asking the Prime Minister a question about food waste.
Kerry McCarthy.
Mr. Speaker, this year is the EU year of tackling food waste. Given the absolute scandal of up to 40% of our food being wasted in this country and the huge numbers of people that we know are having to go to food banks because they can't afford to feed themselves and their family, will the Prime Minister throw his weight behind this initiative and support efforts to reduce food waste in this country?
I think it's important to tackle the issue of food waste, and a number of important debates have been held in this House and in Westminster Hall about this issue. I think the most important thing, though, in terms of helping people with their weekly budgets is to make sure we keep growing the economy, we keep getting people back to work, we keep creating jobs, and also we keep people's taxes down so they have more of their own money to spend as they choose.
Yes, well, he kind of picked up the food waste thing there and then launched into his usual party political broadcast, didn't he? I mean, when I was listening to that, I was just reminded of being a child and so on, you're not getting any pudding until you've eaten your spinach, you know. But there you go.
I mean, this is a serious issue, isn't it? Latest figures, 500,000 people now dependent on food banks in Britain.
Well, it's appalling. I mean, there is quite clearly a growing underclass which is being criminalised, marginalised, and generally pushed around, and I see a lot of people I know are getting the mental health issues for people on benefits and people struggling at the bottom are becoming really, really serious. Housing is becoming an absolute nightmare for people, especially for young people.
It's really
they can't get a foot, and of course the 75% of British MPs who are millionaires live in a different world.
75%?
75%.
I don't think that can
possibly be true.
Well, okay, well, we'll look at the statistics. But basically, that was a non-reply from the Prime Minister. He was just pushing the question away. And really, it's a matter for, again, going back to what Martin said, it's capitalism through the supermarkets, and there's overproduction of materials, and instead of recycling them in some way that's useful, they get thrown out, the food waste. Now, whether by taxing or some other method you can get the Tesco's of this world to change the ways, I don't know, but that's what Kerry was asking for, I suspect. and we'll see what happens.
Okay. Now, Stephen Mosley asked a question about youth unemployment.
Stephen Mosley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 2009, there were 610 18 to 24-year-olds in Chester who were out of work and claiming Job Seekers Allowance. Last month, that number almost halved to 330. Yeah. National Apprenticeship Week. So would the Prime Minister congratulate employers who are creating apprenticeships, creating jobs and creating opportunities for young people so we never again see the massive waste of young talent?
That's right.
Honourable friend is absolutely right to raise National Apprenticeship Week, which is a really important moment to advertise to businesses large and small the advantages of taking on apprentices. What we're going to see during this Parliament is 2 million apprenticeship starts. That is what we are aiming for. 1.6 million have already taken place. As he says, unemployment in his own constituency has fallen, as has the claimant count, but we want to see many more apprentices, and we also want to see smaller firms coming forward and taking on their first
apprentices, I guess that was. Sorry, I cut off a few words today. But Martin, this is not a typical question about youth unemployment. It's the other side of the coin. Most of the questions at Prime Minister's questions were actually bemoaning an increase in youth unemployment. But we're hearing in some parts of the country it's falling rapidly.
There's still a million people under the age of 25 without work. That's just reality. And don't forget that we've got virtually zero interest rates, and we've been putting the foot to the floor for 4 years, and we're just seeing unemployment coming down. And of course, plenty of people are self-employed and therefore counted as employed, but in actual fact, they're on working tax credits. Several of my friends are in exactly this position. They're not on benefits directly. They're supposedly self-employed, but they're actually living on working tax credit. And those figures are completely misleading if you think that all of these people who are supposedly employed are actually employed. They're not.
I agree with that. And there's two other quick points I need to make. The first one is this unnecessary recession has been going on for 5-6 years now. And if children, youngsters coming out of school for, say, 4 years ago, and they haven't been employed since they left school, it becomes more and more difficult for them to get into employment because there are people backing up afterwards. And I just think it's just ridiculous that the economy was being allowed to wither as it has for the last 4 years, particularly under the present government. It was unnecessary. And lots of people said it was unnecessary, including Ed Balls, who's not the most popular politician in the country, but he said that.
But too. Doug, what about the figures? Martin's arguing that he thinks that the figures are being massaged.
Of course they are being massaged. Yeah, it's absolutely true. Yeah, they are.
So you think that actually there are a lot more even than government statistics are saying?
I mean, there's no doubt there's a feeling about that things are getting, even if it's only slightly, they're getting better. And you can sort of feel that. But it's nothing like as much as the government is suggesting in real terms is happening.
In the Huffington Post, this is yesterday, the headline is Ian Duncan Smith's statistical foul play exposed for the fourth time in a year. Ian Duncan Smith's been caught up in a new row over his department's dodgy use of official figures for the fourth time in a year. The controversy erupted after top Department for Work and Pensions official Neil Cooling tried to defend the government's work programme during a grilling by members of Parliament Work and Pensions Committee using unpublished data, which angered MPs as they did not have a chance to properly scrutinise the figures. Labour member Sheila Gilmore complained to Sir Andrew Dilnot, chair of the UK Statistics Authority, who confirmed the published official statistics should be referred to in all public statements and that alternative information should be used only in exceptional circumstances. Sir Andrew added, "It's a matter of regret that Department for Work and Pensions' usual practice, which would have ensured compliance with national statisticians' guidance, was not followed." Martin?
Well, he's got serial form for this, hasn't he? As long as he believes he's right, then it doesn't matter what the figures are. And of course, this is the chap who put on his CV that he went to the University of Perugia, except that he didn't.
Well, last May, Sir Andrew Dilnot was rebuked by Tory chairman Grant Shapps after he mistakenly suggested 900,000 ESA, Education Support Allowance, I believe, applicants had dropped their claim rather than go through a fit for work test. The real figure was actually only 19,000. So we're talking about, 1
20th of the real amount. Mm. And this is statistics being given to members of parliament and others who are trying to make official decisions based on those statistics, Doug.
Well, I mean, I used to know quite a little bit about statistics when I was doing genetics and immunology, and it's everybody who does statistics knows that it's possible to present figures in a good light and a not so good light. And Ian Duncan Smith is a past master at making sure that the real underlying figures are not released, and it's a figures which have some kind of massage, which is what was put out by his department. And as Martin says, he has form on this.
Well, a couple more stories on unemployment. Dole queue for the young would go from London to Edinburgh, says research. And also, government's universal job match website is bedeviled with fraud, Martin. This week, the Channel 4 News have been doing several reports explaining that many of the jobs on there just simply do not exist. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs, which are multiple non-existent jobs from the same job.
Well, we know that for every vacancy, there are five people chasing. Mm. I had a job interview myself for Unison, actually, not long ago. I didn't get it. It went to a younger person. But, I mean, the point is that we're only getting unemployment falling as an official figure because they've decided to take the foot off the gas on austerity, and they've decided to try and have a boomlet to win the next election. Yeah. But of course, the underlying problem is that the banks are bust and we've got zero interest rates. So as soon as interest rates go up, like a Ukraine crisis could force them up, the whole thing will collapse. And it's all based on sand.
Doug, well, they're saying 350,000 job adverts seem to be in breach of the government's universal job match's own website's terms and conditions.
Well, something should be. I mean, I don't understand how they can get away with that. I mean, that should be something that could be fairly easily examined. And if there was a member of parliament who wanted to make a big fuss about it using false statistics, would be a serious breach.
11,000 positions advertised which don't actually exist at all.
That's outrageous. It's utterly outrageous.
So we're being told, on the one hand, that there's all these jobs there, and I suppose it's, again, to do with trying to pretend that it's actually easier for people who are out of work to get work than it is.
Yeah.
I think the real problem is long-term unemployed people. The longer it goes on, the more difficult it is to get a job. And you've got to try and keep your morale up focused. But of course, it actually gets more and more tougher and tougher. And of course, in Iceland, for example, they increased unemployment benefits as one of the things they did. Yeah. And of course, what you're doing by squeezing benefits down for all of these people at the bottom is the macroeconomic effect of that at local level is that poor communities, places like Middlesbrough and Merthyr Tydfil and so on, go into a downward spiral. So people haven't got the money to go to the shops.
At the same time, London is booming. And it's ridiculous.
Okay, well, thanks. Time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to this week's guest, former Bristol MP, now Labour councillor for Avonmouth, Doug Naismith. After the Murdoch News, well, Kiev is in the hands of the pro-EU Ukrainians, but Sevastopol and Crimea is in the hands of the pro-Russians. We talked to Marina Morris, who's just flown back from eastern Ukraine. After the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. There have been more dramatic developments in the Stephen Lawrence scandal. The head of Scotland Yard's counter-terrorism unit has been moved to a non-operational role. The IPCC has apologised to Stephen's parents for prolonging their search for truth. And former Met Police Commissioner Lord Condon has denied knowledge of any undercover officer being sent to spy on the family. Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, who's currently in the role, believes him.
It's just physically impossible to know everything, and it's possible systems fail. But my duty is to make sure that I do my very best professionally and honestly and openly to help all the inquiries to get to the bottom of what happened so long ago and to reassure that the Met of today is honest and open.
A former girlfriend has alleged that Oscar Pistorius once fired a gun out of a car sunroof and cheated on her with Reva Steenkamp. He denies murdering the model on Valentine's Day last year. Police are linking a possible methadone link to the death of a two-year-old girl. Two people have been arrested on suspicion of the manslaughter of Sophie Jones in Blackpool. Russian President Vladimir Putin has officially declared the 2014 Sochi Paralympic Winter Games open. Ukraine's 22 athletes chose not to take part in the opening ceremony flag-bearing parade in protest at the situation in Crimea. Sir Philip Craven, president of the International Paralympic Committee, called for the focus at the Games to be on